have with us live in the studios once again, John Parrish and Maria Tomchick, both with Eat the State. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right. Let's start out with local and recycling.
Yeah, some good news this week. Seattle single-family homes now recycle 70% of their waste, which is a new high in the city of Seattle. The entire city, that includes condos, apartments, and businesses, recycles about 53.7% of their waste, which is also up from prior years. Commercial recycling in the last year had the biggest increase in 2010. They increased their recycling by about 4%, up to 58.9%, which means, of course, that landlords, you're lagging. You got to step up and start helping your tenants recycle more. In addition, some other good environmental news this week, the city of Portland banned plastic bags in supermarkets, with supermarkets that have 2 million or more in sales and stores with pharmacies in at least 10,000 square feet. So it was really directed at large supermarkets and those big box stores like Target and Walmart. They didn't ban them outright, so small stores can still use the plastic bags. And they didn't impose a fee on the use of paper bags, although they do. The ordinance that they passed does allow stores and supermarkets to put a fee on small paper bags in order to cover their costs. So it was a victory, sort of a halfway victory though, because if you don't put a fee on the use of paper bags and you don't ban plastic bags outright, then you're not giving people a real incentive to bring a reusable bag.
Although, again, this was not something that got derailed by the American Chemistry Council or Chemical Council.
Yeah, again.
Did they try?
Very interesting. I don't know if they tried or not, but
I just can't believe they filled out on a job like that.
But again, remember there was no fee imposed, whereas the Seattle ordinance would have imposed a 20-cent fee per bag.
And that was the big mistake, because it gave the opening for campaigning against it as a tax increase.
So once again, another example of a plastic bag ban that did pass for folks who are interested in getting one passed here. Take a look at that one and take a look at the Bellingham one and see if we can't come up with something.
All right. Moving on, the Seattle City Council, busy this week.
Yeah, the Seattle City Council passed a couple of things this week. One was on Monday they voted unanimously to pass the medical marijuana ordinance that they had been discussing to require medical marijuana dispensaries to get a business license, to pay taxes, to adhere to city land use rules, et cetera, et cetera. They also passed an initiative calling for the state legislature to support expanded hours for bars in the city of Seattle to allow them to serve liquor past 2 a.m. They billed this as a safety issue. The mayor and the police department in particular say that pushing people out of bars at 2 a.m. in the morning is a safety problem. But really, I think they should have called it instead a nuisance problem, because the cops don't like having to respond to loud calls from residents saying, you know, there are loud drunk people outside my apartment building or outside my house screaming at 3 in the morning.
So not, instead of pushing them out at 2 a.m., they're going to push them out at 3 or 4? I mean, I don't see how that helps.
No, I think the idea is they want bars to be able to stay open around the clock so that people will be staggering out at about 6 in the morning when the morning commute starts up. That could be a safety problem. That could be a real safety problem in and of itself.
That's not helpful.
No. So, you know, you trade you're getting awakened at 3 a.m. for getting somebody smashing into you at 6 in the morning. I think I would take the getting woken up at 3 myself.
All right, let's move on. Transportation.
Yeah, a whole bunch of transportation-related stuff happened this week. One of them is the King County Superior Court judge ruled that Initiative 101 will not be on the ballot. I-101 had sought to prevent the city streets and property from being used to build the 99 tunnel. That was the initiative that was sponsored by Elizabeth Campbell and her supporters. And a lot of folks saw that as being more of a threat to the construction of the tunnel than Referendum 1. But as soon as I-101 was announced, city attorney Pete Holmes sued in court to block the initiative, and WashDOT, the Washington Department of Transportation, joined in that lawsuit. Judge Joan DeBook this week ruled that the voters of the city really can't nullify agreements between the city and the state, that they can't prevent the state from building a state highway. I-101, what she said, would have taken away the state's right to build a state highway. But, you know, really it didn't have anything to do with the state per se. It sought simply to prevent city streets and city property from being used. So in essence, what the judge said is that city residents really don't have any say over the use of city roads and city property.
And why, if the whole idea is that the city can't weigh in on agreements between the city council
and the state.
And the state. Yeah. Why is referendum one okay?
Yeah, that's a good question. That's a very good question. But, you know, I guess unless...
Because that, if I'm not mistaken, that's the entire purpose of referendum one.
Yeah, well...
Is to invalidate those three agreements between city council
and
the state.
Exactly. And unless Elizabeth Campbell and her supporters appeal the judge's ruling, I-101 isn't going to be on the ballot, but referendum one will be. And to me, that's a contradiction there. But
and referendum one will be on the ballot next month.
It will be on the ballot next month.
In fact, the ballots get mailed out at the end of next week.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll be talking starting next week about ballot endorsements for the summer
primary. Right. And there's some more transportation related stuff that happened this week. Publicola came out with a little report of funding for the Pro Tunnel campaign. The Pro Tunnel campaign, which calls itself Let's Move Forward, has gathered about $106,400 to oppose referendum one.
They're not calling it We're Going Under?
No. They ought to, though. The Let's Move Forward folks, their largest contributor is the Downtown Seattle Association. That's no surprise. Which gave them $25,000. But also they have support from some unexpected folks, like the King County Labor Council gave them $12,500. And the Boeing Machinists Union gave them $5,000. In addition, Seattle Mariners gave them $5,000. That's no surprise. Weston Hotel gave them $3,500, and developer Wright Runstad gave them $10,000. In total, they had
a surprise.
171 contributors to the Let's Move Forward campaign. Now, the anti-tunnel folks, they've managed to, the referendum one supporters, they've managed to gather about $78,000. Their biggest donor is the Sierra Club, which gave them $16,715. Real Change newspaper contributed about $3,000, and there were about 264 other smaller contributors. So you can kind of see who's weighing in to support and defeat that referendum. Also this week, Publicola reported that they saw some flyers that were put out by the Let's Move Forward campaign that said that there was transit funding in the tunnel project. So they said, transit funding? Money in the tunnel project? We haven't heard anything about that. Let's call up the King County Department of Transportation. So they got them on, they got Ron Postuma on the phone, and he said, what are you talking about? You know, transit funding in the tunnel project, by and large, is just not there. You know, there's no transit funding in the tunnel project. What they might be referring to, they're not lying, what they might be referring to is about $31 million that the state is going to give to fund transit mitigation while a portion of the tunnel is being built south of downtown, that you can't really call that transit funding. So you can't really believe Let's Move Forward. You know, in their minds, there's money,
reporters that take official pronouncements and actually pick up the phone and call somebody
and
to
actually
verify
call
it?
To ask, is that really there? Yeah. So that was very interesting. And also this week, the big news on the transportation front that you saw on TV and read in the newspapers is about the $100 that your car tab fees could be going up after November, which would take the average automobile car tab fee to about $190, certainly not the $30 that folks voted for when I-695 passed. That $100 includes the $20 car tab fee that the county council is going to be voting on Monday, and an $80 fee proposed by the city council in order to fund bicycle, pedestrian, and street improvements. Now, the $80 fee, if the city council approves it, would have to go to voters in November because they don't have direct, the city doesn't have direct authority from the state legislature to impose that fee. Now, the county council does have the okay from the state legislature to impose the $20 car tab fee. On the other hand, instead of directly voting for it as they should, they will probably wimp out on Monday during their council vote, and they will probably send it to voters. They should pass it outright for a number of reasons. One, because they can. They don't have to send it to voters. Secondly, because it's their job to do it. The voters elected them to make these kinds of decisions, not to wimp out at the last moment and send a necessary fee to the voters to decide on. And thirdly, because people who make less than the median income in King County cannot afford to live within walking distance of where most of the jobs are, which are in downtown. The neighborhoods around that surround downtown are far, far too expensive for people who make less than the median income to afford to rent there. It really is ridiculous. And when that is the case, when the city's policies over the last decade and a half have been to push people out to the margins, you really have to provide transportation services for them. And if you don't do that, you are literally cutting people off from their lifeline.
And the irony of this, of course, is that the city of Seattle's stated policy at this point is to discourage car travel and to try and encourage alternatives to it. But by putting the $80 car tab fee on the ballot, yeah, the city council is really condemning or vastly increasing the chances that a similar $20 countywide fee would have
pass.
A much more difficult time passing. Now, mind you, two-thirds of voters in King County live outside the city limits, and so they would only have the $20 fee. But still, that leaves one-third of voters who are looking at a much larger tab, no pun intended. And if they vote one down, they're not likely to split their ballot and vote for Metro. They're likely to vote no on both of them.
Yeah, and I just want to remind folks too that I know our listeners probably support these fees, but a lot of people out there don't. And you know, the next time you hear a friend or a coworker or a neighbor or a relative say, "I don't want to pay an extra $100 on my car tabs to fund some guy in spandex riding his bike to work," you should remind him that that we used to get money from the federal government for transportation projects, but that money is no longer there. And it's no longer there because a few years back, our representatives in Congress passed tax reform that gave tax breaks to the rich in the United States. And they decided we should go to war in Iraq and Afghanistan. And because that there's no longer money in the federal budget, you have to shell out for necessities. The money that you paid previously over the past decade for these projects went down a black hole in Iraq and Afghanistan, and it went into the pockets of people who live on Mercer Island. So right now, the check that you make out to the county for your car tab, you know, to the state for your car tab fees that you think is going for these transportation projects, it you might as well be making out your check to some guy who lives on Mercer Island, because really we're going to be paying for that money we gave away over the past decade. We're going to be paying for it for the next 25 or 30 years.
Yeah. And I would also say that in terms of people who don't support this because they only drive, they don't take transit, they don't ride their bicycles, whatever, that guy in spandex or that woman on a bus, they are people who are not in single occupancy vehicles tying up traffic with you. And yeah, that is important too.
Yes.
That does provide a direct benefit to people who do drive.
So as of Friday, I heard that King County Council was one vote short of having
That's where they've been for months.
Yeah, they now have five council members who support the car tab fee, and Jane Haig has finally stepped up and said, "Well, I will vote to send it to the ballot, but I won't vote to pass it outright." So if you want to contact county council members to say pass this, it's your job to do this. I think Jane Haig should be at the top of the list.
All right. Finally, on local stuff happening over at Longview.
Yeah, major labor dispute happening in Longview, Washington, down south of here, between here and Portland. The 100 ILWU dock workers were arrested on July 11th, and then a number of them blocked a train on July 14th, having to do with a new grain terminal on the Columbia River at the port of Longview, owned by the international conglomerate EGT. They have sued the port of Longview to try and opt out from the ILWU Local 21 contract for all longshore workers on Port of Longview property. Now, all port grain elevators on the lower Columbia River, as well as all of them in Puget Sound, those are all union jobs. And what EGTG is trying to do basically is break the union. Now, over this past week, what EGT has announced is that they will hire 25 to 30 engineers from a union contractor using another union. So they're still not honoring the ILWU contract with the port. But the reason all of this, aside from the fact that it's one of the bigger labor disputes to happen in the state of Washington in a long time, with 100 people getting arrested and that getting almost no media attention in the rest of the state, including in Seattle. Aside from that, the reason this is particularly interesting is that brand new grain facility, that port loading facility terminal, is a taxpayer-developed facility. And the reason it was funded by taxpayers is, of course, to create jobs. So what EGT is turning around and doing is importing most of their non-union workers from outside the state. So they're not creating any local jobs in a local county that has 13% official unemployment. And also, speaking of tax breaks for the wealthy, it turns out that they get a state tax exemption that goes to, and this is a direct quote from the RCW law, the equivalent of 100% of the amount of tax paid for qualifying construction materials, service, and labor. In other words, EGT does not have to pay any taxes on the labor for those non-union jobs. This is what we are subsidizing instead of subsidizing things like mass transit or health care. It really is outrageous. And this, again, is something to keep watching, because the ILWU is not going to go away on this.
All right. Moving on to national and this week's weather.
Yeah, well, we've had an extraordinary once in a hundred years weather event, it seems like. This week we've had amazing heat throughout much of the country. The only place, in fact, where it hasn't been record heat has been around here, where we've had abnormally cool weather all spring and summer. But this is on top of there were massive dust storms again this week in the Phoenix area in Arizona, and this is on top in recent months. The flood of the Mississippi River, tornadoes, drought across much of the southern part of the country, wildfires. There is nothing, absolutely nothing, being proposed at the federal level right now regarding climate change, and no media coverage of climate change. All of these extraordinary weather events, and nobody can even bring themselves to mention the word climate change. Not corporate media, not the Republicans, and not the Democrats. The only people doing anything, in fact, around climate change or proposing anything are the Republicans. And this brings us to the debt ceiling crisis. The Republican deal on the debt ceiling crisis, Tom Coburn, the senator from Oklahoma, the most prominent climate change denier in the U.S. Senate, had a proposal this week to cut $9 trillion from the federal budget. There are a number of these Republican proposals floating around there right now that would essentially eviscerate
each successive one getting more extreme.
Exactly. Yeah. They're trying to move the goalposts, basically, so that by the time they compromise on something that would have been considered beyond the pale in the first place.
They talk about Obama moving the goalposts. They keep moving it further and further and further out.
Yeah, they keep doubling down on the crazy is what it boils down to. Yes. But they're basically talking about, maybe not saving a little bit of money on military spending, certainly not saving any money on making the wealthy pay anything like what they've historically paid in terms of tax rates. In fact, many of these proposals have more tax cuts for the wealthy. In fact, House Republican plan, the tax cuts for the wealthy wind up making the entire plan not particularly save any money at all. But they eviscerate almost all other regulatory and social spending, including in the House plan a 70% cut in investment in clean energy. So that's the Republican proposal for climate change, is to pour some gasoline on the fire, basically. Meanwhile, we had, in terms of the debt ceiling, when the deadline is August 2nd, so it's coming up in about 10 days, they're really running out of time for Congress to do anything on this without a shutdown of federal government. So it's looking very, very possible indeed that people who depend, for example, on Social Security checks, August may be the last time you get yours for a while. We may wind up with the U.S. government shutting down for a few days before people come to their senses, and that's going to have a devastating effect on the economy.
Yeah, that's not just going on up in the stratosphere somewhere. That's going to affect state and local governments. It's going to affect the things that happen around you. It's going to affect whether transportation projects move forward. It's going to affect education funding. It's going to affect whether your schools can buy books or not, because, you know, the federal government sends funding out to states and local governments and school districts all over the country. And when that doesn't happen, you feel the effects pretty quickly.
Yeah, with the exception of a few wingnut commentators, there really is a broad consensus on what the effect of this would be to the economy. Mm-hmm. In fact, it's such a broad consensus that you literally had Grover Norquist going on CNN this week and telling his Republican colleagues to cut a deal because defaulting would be a disaster. You know, you've reached a state of complete ridiculousness when Grover Norquist is your voice of reality on federal spending and raising taxes.
Yeah.
I mean, it really has become the Republicans, particularly in the House of Representatives, are valuing ideology over reality at this point. And we're all looking at the consequences as a result. Come down to the question of who elected these people and can we please make them go away?
All right. Let's move on to this week's economic news.
Yeah, there was a report by the Associated Press this week about mortgage robo-signing. Folks might remember robo-signing as a problem in foreclosure cases where companies would have their employees sign the name of a single person without having read the documents. That means that the signature on the documents are not valid. The documents have not been reviewed, and so that can bring the foreclosure to a complete halt, and can invalidate a foreclosure as well. Well, it turns out that the banks have not learned anything. They paid a settlement over the foreclosure robo-signing problems in April, but it was a small sum, and there were no penalties attached.
A fraction compared to the amount of money they made off the practice.
Exactly, and it turns out now, according to this Associated Press review, that they're doing mortgage robo-signing, but not of foreclosure documents now, per se, but mostly on sale documents. So that brings up the interesting question of, well, you know, the sale documents that are signed when a piece of property changes hands, those documents establish legal title for the property. And if you have robo-signed documents there that are not valid, then you may not have a valid title to the property you just purchased. That could be a very serious problem. And it's one of those things that you keep hearing, one of those abuses that you keep hearing about that make you wonder, what the heck happened? Didn't we pass a reform bill to try to take care of this stuff?
No.
Haven't the banks learned anything?
No.
Well, yes, we passed the bill, but no, none of the reform has really taken effect because the funding is just not there. And the Republicans in Congress have been doing their best to gut these agencies. As an example, the House Appropriations Committee, the Republican-controlled House Appropriations Committee, decided to cut the SEC's funding by $22.5 million this week. That made absolutely no sense in terms of dealing with the federal debt, because the SEC doesn't get its money from the federal government. The SEC gets its entire budget from fees it charges Wall Street firms, particularly financial companies like banks and other financial companies. They pay their money directly to the SEC, and that funds the SEC's activities in regulating them. When you cut the SEC's budget, what you're doing is you're taking that $222.5 million. It's not going to pay down the federal debt. No, it's going right back into the pockets of Wall Street companies.
But if you're working for Wall Street in the first place, it makes plenty of sense.
Oh, it makes perfect sense if you're lobbying for that, yes. In addition, the Treasury Department this week sold the last of its Chrysler stock. You might ask, was the bailout profitable, as the Treasury Secretary promised us it would be? Well, no. Turns out the taxpayers took a $1.3 billion loss overall on bailing out Chrysler. You might say, well, at least we saved a U.S. automaker, right? Well, no, we didn't save a U.S. automaker. Chrysler is now majority owned by Fiat, an Italian company, who has said, the CEO of Fiat this week said that they will do away with Chrysler's management team, and they will merge the two companies so they will operate as a single company. Chrysler. Well,
weren't they owned by Daimler before?
They were owned by, yes, but the idea was to save U.S. jobs. Well, in any merger, as you well know, a lot of jobs get taken away. In this case, Fiat said immediately they would take away a whole bunch of jobs, particularly at the management level, and I'm sure more jobs will be cut as well. And in addition, what I want to point out is that this all would have happened anyway if Chrysler had gone through bankruptcy. Their assets would have been bought up by a foreign company, probably by Fiat. It would have happened a lot sooner, and the Chrysler shareholders would have taken the $1.3 billion loss, not the taxpayer. So that's the difference. That's the real difference when the government steps in to do a bailout. It means they're bailing out Chrysler shareholders so that the shareholders don't have to take the loss. Taxpayers take the loss instead. And then this week, finally, Richard Cordray was appointed by the Obama administration, or proposed by the Obama administration, to be the new head of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. They had every opportunity to appoint the person who set up the bureau, Elizabeth Warren, to be the new head. But they saw that she wouldn't be approved by Congress. They shouldn't be approved by the Senate. But that was not the main reason, I tell you, because Cordray has been working as Elizabeth Warren's number two man at the agency for a while now, and both of them would have a tough time passing a Senate vote. But the difference here is Timothy Geithner, the head of Obama's economic team, Treasury Secretary Geithner. He likes members of his economic team and the heads of all these regulatory agencies to be people who will answer to him and the Obama administration agenda. And when they're too independent, he doesn't like them. And that's been the case with Elizabeth Warren. She's not a great a friend of Timothy Geithner, and so they passed her over, and they went for Cordray.
And she is independent, which
she's very much a maverick.
You would think is something you would want in a situation like that, but
at a regulatory agency, but apparently not.
All right, just 2 minutes left. Obama administration and gay rights.
Yes, we started with some good news in this program, so we'll end with some good news as well, just, you know, for the novelty of it. Obama formally ended Don't Ask, Don't Tell on Friday, and he also this week endorsed the Respect for Marriage Act. Now, that's a bill pending in Congress that would repeal the Defense of Marriage Act, and in other words, would repeal the federal ban on gay marriage. And then lastly, but certainly not leastly, the first openly gay federal judge was confirmed this week by the Senate. J. Paul Okun was confirmed by the Southern District of New York State, in district court. And the interesting part of that is that it got almost no media attention. It was completely non-controversial, and that really, more than anything else, is a measure of just how far we have come on GLTBQCDX. PW rights over the last 10, 15, 20 years, that it's not even a big deal anymore in some of these cases. And that's very, very exciting news.
All right. And then finally, if you can do it 30 seconds or less, Rupert Murdoch.
Can we just laugh for 30 seconds? go ahead.
Yeah. Oh, no. It became very clear this week what close collusion there was between the Murdoch empire and Scotland Yard when it was found that Scotland Yard had three bags full of documents taken from the home of the guy who hacked phones for News of the World and other Murdoch-owned publications. And they didn't even look at any of the documents. They stored them in a room in the basement. Those documents contained evidence of hacking on the phones of thousands, literally close to 5,000 or 6,000 people at the last estimate. And at the same time that Scotland Yard had those documents, they didn't look at them. They purposely told the media that and the company that, oh, it was only a couple dozen people that whose phones they hacked, yada, yada, yada. This was at the same time as these guys were having, the lead investigators were having dinner with folks from the News of the World as they were supposedly investigating them.
And if you have that kind of a collusion happening at the highest corporate levels between News Corp employees and law enforcement in Britain, it makes you wonder if there's similar collusion going on in the United States.
Here in the United States, where Murdoch's empire is based.
Talking as we do every week with Job Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
www.eatthestate.org. Comments, news, tips, comics, all kinds of fun stuff, global, national, local. You can find it there, eatthestate.org.